This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Unfinished Business, The Mother Trucker. Is the subtitle. And joining me from the New York City area is Nadine Shelby Schramm. Nadine, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating story. It starts in Arkansas in the mid-30s, something like that. You come from a family of 11 children. Share with my audience a little of your early life and how in the world you ended up in New York City area.
Well, I grew up on a farm in Arkansas. I was one of 11 children. We lost a twin of my younger sister shortly after birth to pneumonia, back before we had the antibiotics we have today. I grew up such a happy child, and I look back and think how fortunate I was. A lot of people would say, how could you be so happy when you're just one of so many?
Right.
But we never felt as if we were not the special one. Each and every one of us, my mom and dad had the ability to listen to each one of us, to our little problems, and make us feel that it was very important what we were doing.
And do I understand correctly your father was blind? Was he blind as you were when you were a child, or is that something that happened later in life?
No. It's a hereditary disease in my family. My father's mother had it, and then my father had it, and then half of my siblings were blind.
Really?
Yes, and so I was one of the fortunate ones, and I still have nieces and nephews have it. And my lineage, I didn't have it, my daughter didn't have it, and my grandchildren don't. And now my understanding is that that has been broken in my line, that, you know, we don't have to worry about in my own family having it ever.
And your family was, I'm understanding, farmers. Would that be the right description of your early childhood?
Oh, yes, farm girl. I was farming the fields with my blind father when I was 10 years old. I actually plowed cotton behind two 1,600-pound horses with my father holding the straps of the horses in case they spooked. And I felt so fortunate. When I look back, I wonder how I could have thought I was so special, but I was. And my father, I will tell you, and all the people, he's still the smartest person I've ever known.
Incredible. And I've read one part of your story where your father would go to the banker. The banker would give him cash and put it in certain denominations, and your father would remember that and use that to carry on a business. And also, if he was given a task to do from mom, like things to pick up in town, he would remember them exactly as given to him, correct?
Correct. And that was to feed 12 of us.
Amazing. And yet your story takes on a twist that is not one that would be expected. This is not just a very simple autobiographical sketch that you've shared. Your life took a turn for what some would describe as a negative twist. Describe that for us as well.
Well, I was a young girl working at a company called Dixie Cup, which is now International Paper. And I worked, and there was an army camp in Camp Chaffee. And I would never date soldiers. I dated just local boys. And there was a girlfriend who dated this one soldier. And she was one tough cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out with her a few times, and she was too tough for him. So he decided that he wanted to date me, and I didn't want to date him, but he kept being outside our place of work when we all got off work, and so I was embarrassed, and finally I thought, well, I'll just go out with him and show him I'm not for him. And I went out with him, and I lived with one of my sisters in an apartment building, and a little house, actually, that had three separate apartments. And so I went out with him, and just to let him know that I wasn't for him. And as we got back, as I said goodnight to him on the front porch, and I put my key in the door and opened the door, and he came back, shoved me inside, and I fought him for half hour, 45 minutes. He raped me, and then he started to, he was in service, and I was scared to death because I didn't know what to do, and I was going to press charges, but then I went to talk to my mom and dad. And my father said, you know, Nadine, let the service take care of him. He'll get out and he will leave. But instead, he took me to a justice of peace and married me, baby marrying, because he told me how I should run my barn father down on the dirt road.
Oh, yes.
And I was so scared that I married him. Only thing is, now he's in the service and he married me under an assumed name. And he had a car that he left with me because he lived on the camp and he couldn't keep a car there. So he left the car with me and he called me to bring it out to him. And the battery was dead. I had to let him know that, you know. So I called the camp where he was in the hospital and asked for him. And they told me there was nobody there by that name but to describe him. And when I did, they knew exactly who it was. And so they sent a couple of guys to talk to him, and they told me I needed to make charges against him, that he would go to prison for life being in the service and using an assumed name and marrying me under an assumed name. And I said, I have to talk to my mom and dad, and I went down. And my father, they didn't know what to do. They just wanted him to leave town and me get a divorce and be over with.
Right.
But he came, and he told me to pack my bags. We were leaving.
And you remained in that abusive relationship under duress for a while, and then somehow ended up in New York City. That part is a fascinating turn of events, because there you ended up starting your own company, or starting a business with no money and just with the kindness of someone you had met.
I had gone into a garden city, a garden center, in a little town, Irving, Texas. And they had the family wanted to have a little box of vials of perfume, like 24 vials. And I always had a good nose for recognizing fragrances. So when I walked over and I picked up the perfume and I kept picking one up, I said, ooh, that's Chalamar.
Mm-hmm.
Chanel. I could name them all. So I go over to the guy and I said, he has a sign on dollar a vial. I walked over and I said, what are you going to do with those? And he says, just what I'm doing, sell them. And I said, well, do you mind if I do something? And now, where this came from, but I say it was God-given. He said, you can do anything you want. So I looked down on the corner of the box and it gave the address of a man in Long Island City, New York, where it was from. So I took the name and the telephone number, and I called the man, and I said, you know, I would like to come to New York and talk to you about the perfumes. And he said, fine.
Uh-huh.
So I told him, and I will never know how I thought of this, but I designed sample boxes just as, and I never will forget, I went to Railway Express, which was my first big order. And I've made up a design on the box. I still have one of their boxes of their logo on the box.
Mm-hmm.
I walk in. I called. I never will forget. I called, found out the name of the president of the company, called him, told him, now you have to remember this is years ago when I'm a young woman. And I call up this president of this company. I said,
that's right.
I have something you'd like to see. Now, how suggestive is that?
Yeah,
and And I said, I just need 5 minutes. Anyway, I made an appointment with this guy. I walked in, and he took one look at it, and he said, I want to make these up, and you give them as gifts to your customers.
Brilliant.
He said, I think that's a wonderful idea. Where did you think of this? I said, don't ask me, just let's do it. Mm. And he was my first customer.
Brilliant creativity for business to do that. That was not the end of your story, though. You have pioneered or been instrumental in building several companies, including the one of your second husband that has become a very successful business. How did that develop? You were able to get out of that bad relationship, get out on your own, prove that you were a doer, someone that could get things done, and then met the love of your life. How did that happen?
Well, it's very funny how I met him. I met him, and I get a little fuzzy on this because so many things have happened to me. But I met him in a meeting, and I remembered when I met him thinking, wow, his wife has got to be one of the luckiest women in the world. He's a gentleman, handsome, and at that time, you know, I was young. I got, if I made 4 calls in a day, I got 2 calls to go out to dinner, all of married men. So I wrote down on a piece of paper next to my phone, I can still see it today, I wrote down, oh, another married man looking for the night out on the town.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, you know, the guys would back off, so they knew I, you know, it wasn't going to work for them. So I said that to Bud Schramm, and he said, pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
I received it, and he said, well, I am separated. And I said, oh, for now? And he said, well, no, I've been out of the house for 3 months, and I filed for divorce. And I thought, oh, boy. So I went out with him. And I explained to him after. I went out with him for several months, and he was taking me. You have to remember that his family was fairly well-to-do, considering. And so he had credit cards, you know, from his company, the family.
Correct.
So he was taking me to all these wonderful restaurants, and I began to feel a little bit guilty because I knew this was not going to go anywhere as far as I was concerned. I was busy with my business. So I told him one night, and he said to me, well, can we just continue the way we are?
Hmm.
And he told me how long it was taking to get a divorce, and that he just enjoyed my company. And I said, fine with me. Now he's already bringing his 2 daughters in. To, you know, he has them on weekends. So he always wanted me to be with them. And I kind of felt that he should spend his time with them. But then he said, they always ask for you. They want you to be with us.
Right.
So anyway, it worked.
It worked because he was a gentleman and you were in no hurry.
Right. Everybody else was running after him, and I wasn't. There's no pressure with me.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful story. You also have given insight into kind of the, I would say, the golden years of, not the golden years, of necessarily of Las Vegas, but you had several opportunities to meet some of the Rat Pack and other people. You have woven some wonderful personal tales in with your descriptions of your biographical life, of your charming life. It didn't start out charming, but ended up to be a very successful life. Are you still involved in the transport business or the?
Yeah, I own 80 trucks.
80 trucks. And those trucks are not just hauling furniture. What exactly are you doing with those?
Any movie that's filmed in New York, my trucks are on them. I do the trucking for CBS, the Metropolitan Opera, the Philharmonic. I do the concerts in the park for the Met and the Philharmonic. I move the Macy's Parade.
Wow. So you're still having fun then in business?
If I'm not having fun, nobody is.
What do you feel is the underlying I guess, positive message that people will get from reading your book, which is over 300 pages, by the way, for my listeners. It's a well-thought-out and descriptive tale of a life that has become one of success. How would you describe the underlying message? What do you think it would be? What would inspire people the most?
Go with your dreams.
Go with your dreams. And don't be afraid to take chances. I would say that also would be part of what you have done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you're kind of, I always describe it as being a turtle. If you don't stick your neck up, you're not going to move.
This is true. Are you planning to do a sequel to this? I know this has taken a number of years. People were prodding you for years to share your story, and you finally have released this. Are you planning to do a sequel, perhaps?
Not unless God's got me a lot of years to go.
Wonderful story. It's fun to read and also very heartwarming in many ways. Readers, you'll laugh, you'll cry, and you'll be inspired by her story. Nadine, you've also been bold enough to share some personal insight into the political goings-on in the 60s and some of your opinions about what might have happened or did happen to our political system and to some of our leaders, which I also find charming and also insightful. Nadine, share with my listeners where they can get a copy of your book, Unfinished Business.
Amazon.com.
And listeners also by request, I'm thinking, from your local bookseller.
Amazon is the best place.
Amazon's the best. And the title of the book, again, is Unfinished Business. And the author who has joined me from New York, thank you, Nadine Shelby Schramm, S-C-H-R-A-M-M, if you're looking for her books online, her book online. And this is written and published by Archway Press.
Also, it's on the website, www.Nadine Schramm.com.
Thank you, Nadine, for joining me today. I know you have a busy, busy schedule, and thank you for taking time to visit with us today and sharing your story.
I've enjoyed it, and thank you for the interview.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Parker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying, to 14 ways to get a baby to eat, and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book today is titled The 3-Year Affair. And joining me from Ontario, Canada, in North Bay, Ontario, which today is a cold day in Canada, is author Annie Omus. Thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
This is a fascinating book of 144 pages. I say fascinating primarily because of the cover. The cover is certainly interesting, and some might call it provocative. You have a young lady with a beautiful tattoo and a wonderful color facing north. Share with my listeners the title, The 3-Year Affair. What was the motivation behind that, and how did you come to write it?
Well, actually, when I first started writing the book, I didn't really have any intentions of sharing it. I had a few of my close friends that are avid readers read it, and based on their suggestion, I decided to share it. I always kind of wrote for myself, and at the time, my post-traumatic stress disorder was in full swing, and it really helped me deal with a lot of those issues I was facing, and it helped me feel confident to make some serious changes in my life and be honest with myself and others. It forced me really to figure out what path I wanted to continue on with, and writing and publishing seemed to be it.
You mentioned PTSD. Was that military related or was it something else?
It was something else.
Okay, won't ask you the details on that, but those are tough tough things to deal with. I think I have post-birth disorder, but I'm trying to work through that, and after about 80 years, I should be getting better at it. Your book should appeal to whom? Do you think this is a book that is, you know, some people describe books like this as chick flicks or chicklets or other nomenclature. How would you describe the book?
The book itself should appeal to a large group of readers. I did do a focus group made up of people from all walks of life, men and women from ages of 15 all the way up to 87. And the one consistent thing that occurred through with the feedback was that it kept you reading from the beginning to end. And the description that was given to me was a female version of Sons of Anarchy, which I enjoyed. I think it's because it's not just a romance. It touches on a lot of different social issues. It touches on bullying, spousal abuse, subcultural differences, and PTSD.
Fabulous. You have a variety of subject matter that you have approached in this. How long did it take you, Annie, to complete your work?
6 days.
6 days? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I don't mean to sound shocked, but I have some authors that take 15 or 20 years to get something out of their system. Did you begin by writing an outline, or how did you approach this? Or was it just what I would call inspirational or cathartic?
I'd written the intro to begin with, and I, from there, decided I wanted to write a book. And I kind of did an outline, but I focused on certain areas of the book that really were passionate to me, and then kind of sewed it all together. I didn't write from chapter 1 to chapter 15. I think chapter 1 was probably my last chapter.
Really? In writing this, is it going to be a really serious read for someone? Would you call it entertaining? Would you call it action-packed? How would you describe it?
It's been categorized as a romance thriller and mystery. Actually, the Kirkus review that I'd had, they had stated that it was a romance with often grisly novel. It's not just a romance novel. It seems to be in the beginning, but then it twists and turns. It becomes more about understanding yourself and a self journey.
Interesting. This book, then, would you call it entertaining? Will someone really find it a satisfying read?
Yes, that's the feedback I've been getting, for sure. It's romantic, it's sexy, it's a thriller, and it's engrossing.
Where is the setting? Where is the setting for the novel?
Part of it takes place in Canada, Toronto and Northern Ontario, and then as well Winnipeg, Manitoba. But it also takes you on a journey to Africa, Malaysia, Asia, and Japan.
Incredible. And all this in 144 pages, you must be a very focused writer or author in order to accomplish that. Is there one scene that you think will stand out to the reader that will make this a memorable read that they'll never forget?
Well, I could share the intro with you. I may have to change a few words in it, though, so that we can air it.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. I could feel his breath on my neck between kisses as my back hit the wall in the otherwise unoccupied men's room. The intense feeling of panic and desire ran through my body all at once. We have to stop. They're going to realize if we're gone too long, I said between breaths. No, they won't. We'll be quick, he says, trying to keep my attention on the task at hand. Holy crap, I whispered as I tried to fight the urge to open his belt buckle that my fingers somehow had found. His hands travel down my body, grabbing and pulling me into the swirling tornado of passion that has found my center of being. We have to stop. Not here. Not here. I say this time with fortitude. He leans his head on my neck and tries to control his breathing, his body pressed hard against mine. I can feel his excitement as he tries to gather himself. I run my fingers up the back of his neck and through his thick, dark hair, trying to catch my breath as well. Okay, but this is far from over, he whispers in my ear. He leans down and kisses me. I try for a second one. He grins a seductive smile and pulls away, teasing me, making me want him more. Then after what feels like forever, he leans in for the final kiss of the session. I go weak under his control, and in that moment, I know I am screwed.
Well, that gets your attention. Your readership, is this an appealing book, do you think, for both male, female, or and age? I guess there must be an age category that you feel might be appropriately enticed by this novel.
Yes, our main target audience right now are women between the ages of 25 and 50. That seems to be where our sales are landing. I'm hoping as well with the second book, which is going to be released February 14th of next year, The Guild, that we might pick up more of a male audience. The second one is a lot more violent and action-packed. It's got a lot of twists and turns and has been described as Quentin Tarantino-esque. So I'm hoping that we can pick up more of a male audience.
Is there a way that you would categorize your book, maybe, to describe it in a more profound or advanced way?
I think thriller and mystery romance is the best categories for it.
And what is your hope with this book? You mentioned you are doing a trilogy on this aspect of the novel. Is that also correct?
Yes. Like I said, The Guild will be released February 14th, and we're hoping to have the third and final chapter, Redemption, finished and out by Christmas of next year.
That's an ambitious task. You have been very successful in getting this completed in a short turnaround. Were there challenges in getting it to print?
Yeah, actually, the biggest one was the production itself. Not only am I the author, but I'm a part owner of the publishing company, Annie Publishing. It's been a huge learning curve. This industry is giant to jump into, and I don't assume that the learning curve will ever change, which is kind of exciting. We're hoping to have open calls for manuscripts at the end of 2016 once this trilogy is out. And the best thing about it is I've had a chance to work with a lot of really amazing people. I have a formatter, Alana Healy in North Bay. I have a graphic artist and photographer, Brian Bujo from Brian Bujo Photography in North Bay. And he's responsible for the cover shoot and all of my the cover work and all of my PR pictures for our media campaigns. We have a copy editor, William Larichelle, in Toronto, and our very talented McLean tattoo artist, Kayla Backinson from Dead City Studios, and that's the tattoo that you see on the back of the lady on the cover. And we also have a silent partner and our shrewd editor-in-chief, Natasha McDonald.
So that is a real tattoo. That is an actual tattoo on the model on the front.
Yes, it is.
Amazing. Well, mm-hmm. It certainly is identifiable if you ever see her at the beach topless.
Well, it plays into the book. The tattoo is actually in the book. It describes a portion of what's happening with her. So,
your main character in this book, what is their name, and are they carried through to the trilogy?
I'm sorry, can you say again?
The main character, the name of the main character, are they carried through to the next in the series?
Yes, the story continues.
Continues.
It just picks up where it leaves off. And the second edition of this book, which is available now for sale, has a sneak peek to the Guild at the end.
Very good. Thank you for joining me today. The title of the book, again, is The Three-Year Affair. Annie Olmos has been my guest. Now, where do we get copies of your book, those that want to read this or at least get a copy of the cover?
Currently, it's available online. You can get it through Lulu.com, Amazon, Indigo, Barnes & Noble, Nook, Kindle, and iBooks. And we are working right now in discussions with Indigo.ca to try and get the books into Colton Chapters in Canada.
Excellent. Well, best of luck on the books in the future. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. And if you're doing a search online, the author's name again is Annie Olmos. That is spelled in a little unusual manner. Annie is spelled A-N-N-Y. Olmos is O-M-O-U-S. Do a search under that name, and you'll also find the other books when they're released. Thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room, a place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book has an important topic title, Hospice, The Last Responder. And joining me from the Houston area in Texas in the United States, Ellen J. Windham. Welcome to the program, Ellen.
Thank you so much. An honor to be here.
This is an important subject on a number of levels. First of all, my family has experienced caregiving for aging parents and that type of thing. Share with my listeners a little of your background and how you became interested in hospice and why it is something that you feel is vital to share.
I became actually through a very special patient I took care of before I became a hospice nurse. A friend of mine in the Galveston area. And he actually died the night that I was there. And I thought, it was such an awesome privilege to be with someone as they take their last breath and their first breath into the presence of Christ. So I went back to school and actually became a nurse working just in the hospice industry.
The hospice industry is unique in that, at least for the primary family members, they get to experience some of the transition pains, I guess, that could be related to hospice. But not all hospice is an end-of-life thing, is it?
Yes, it actually is. It's not an immediate end of life.
Okay.
The criteria for hospice is that the two physicians have to certify that the patient has 6 months or less to live in their opinion. Now that's the physician's opinion, and it's based on the rules that Medicare in the United States set. Many patients live longer than 6 months because, as we all know, God is in control of how long we are here. So in that case, a person is recertified and can hospice longer and benefit from the services. And that's what we want them to be able to benefit from the services for as long as possible.
You have 208 pages, and it's not just anecdotal history of your being involved in hospice care, but it also has some good research behind it that anyone can benefit from. Who do you think is going to find your book most appealing?
I think that, and that's my hope and prayer, is that every family member or every patient or every friend that has someone that is told by the physicians they need hospice care will benefit from this book. That was my whole purpose in writing it, is that in a concise, condensed way, they know the questions to interview a hospice, what to ask and what to expect from the hospice. There's so often when the doctor comes in and says, there's nothing more we can do, we need to call hospice, that the family members and the patient both are overwhelmed with, they don't know what to do. This book will guide them through that. And not only through everything they have available from hospice, but through the celebration of life, through a bucket list, how to do a bucket list, how to pick a funeral home, and how to know the funeral rules that the Federal Trade Commission has set forth for funeral homes to follow. And I can tell you myself, I did not even know about the funeral rule until I began writing this book and researching that part of it also.
You have
so all of that is in there.
You've mentioned something else that I found fascinating or of interest. 71 countries in the world also deal with the term or the idea of hospice. I was not aware of that. I figured it might be simply a North American idea.
Yes, there are 70. There are 71 countries currently that deal with hospice care. Actually, hospice began in the European countries, and I put a timeline in the book to try to help people understand that's where hospice began, with a European country, and then it moved to America in 1974. So it's really not that old in the United States. It actually, hospice began back in the biblical times. And it's a place for travelers and, that were ill for someone to take in.
Hmm.
So the concept began back in the biblical time, but the movement began in the European countries and spread to the United States.
And up through the 1970s, and which is still part of, I think, the process today, families often took on that responsibility solely until there was some outside help in the 70s.
Yes, either that or they were in a hospital.
Yes.
And they were to tubes, and they had to deal with things. The patient had to deal with things. The family members did, that they didn't. That wasn't their wishes. There are a lot of times as we get older, quality of is more important than the quantity of years that we spend on this earth. Because as Christians, we know we're going home, that we're just passing through here. And,
so you have
many times.
You have a faith element in your book, obviously, from what you've described. The other thing that I think is certainly a topic of discussion worldwide, and especially in Europe, when a person becomes ill, there is a concern, at least in Europe, or at least an option of checking out early. The Hippocratic Oath, how does that equate, or how does it attach itself to hospice care in the United States?
That is one of the largest reasons, the biggest reasons I wanted to write this book. I've seen so many, I began to witness so many, so many states in the United States too, that have physician assisted suicide.
Mm.
There are, and as I put in the book, there are two sides to every issue, and we know that. This is a time that there's not two sides to every issue. Not about physician assisted suicide. Hospice is about caring for that family member for as long as possible, and for them to be at home with family as comfortable as possible. But we want them to be home and comfortable. We don't want them or to take that journey home until God says it's time.
Mm-hmm.
And with physician-assisted suicide, you don't have that choice. That physician in I believe it's Oregon, Vermont, and Washington, the voters have voted on that in those states, and they're still trying to get more states to pass it.
That's incredible. I wasn't aware it was in the United States already.
Yes, it's in the United States. It's called the Death with Dignity Act, and that act goes completely against what we believe in hospice.
You have included a lot of photographs and also some diagrams and sketches and even some templates for making lists, such as like my bucket list and my assistant. How does that work for someone that will buy your book? What do you think they'll learn from that?
I think that they'll learn that not just their family member or friend that's on hospice care, you want them to make a bucket list. It's like everyone needs to make a bucket list because we don't know. We don't know how long we're going to be here. And I think that we should, especially someone who's given a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live in the doctor's opinion, should be able to make a bucket list. And the idea of the bucket, okay, that's, and the shovel, that's the assist, those are the family member and, or the friend and the person that's helping them, the main person. So, to make a bucket list and decide everything you want to do.
While they're still lucid and able to communicate.
Exactly, while they can still communicate.
You've also included an adult wish organization compendium or listing of those organizations that, what would you find in those organizations that will help someone?
I was not aware that we had those organizations in hospice as long as I've been here, working almost 16 years. That adult wish organization came from a lady I took care of last year. The two of us talked about a Make-A-Wish program for adults that are diagnosed with a terminal illness. All she wanted was for her granddaughter to meet one of our famous Houston Texan football players.
Really?
And in the book I stated that she told me that her granddaughter made as much money as he did, which is quite a lot because he's like one of the major defensive players for the Houston Texans. And she just wanted her to meet him. And so we had the social worker from the hospice working on that. And it was, she went home, she died and went, you know, went to heaven before that came to pass because we didn't know right away. So I started researching and found that we have adult wish programs out there that can grant wishes to adults because we have so many for children. I thought that is such a great idea that an adult can have a last wish.
You have mentioned several very fascinating topics in your book. Among them that caught my attention was estranged family members, how to deal with that. Understanding intimacy for the aging dying patient. That one is a curiosity for me. Pre-planning the funeral with the loved ones, medical terminology, and DNR, which is one that comes up in doctor's offices quite frequently when you're dealing with elder patients. What does DNR represent?
The DNR is a do not resuscitate order, and it is something where the family that goes on hospice care needs to have if that's their wish. If that is the patient or the loved one's wish, then the DNR has to be posted in the home so that if emergency personnel are called, we'll not do CPR on that person and try to bring them back.
Nothing out of the ordinary. Is there anything in your book on a personal level that you feel is something that is going to stick with the reader, maybe a personal event that transpired?
I think possibly the estranged family member, because I dealt with that myself last April, actually. And as I mentioned in the book, my sister I had not seen for 4 years.
Mm.
And I went to see her. Tim and I went to see her, and we did that because God told us to do it. We just felt in our heart that we should go. And when I chart, I knew how sick she was. And when I saw her, I knew how sick she was. So I really didn't remember anything of the past. And I just brought her home, and she lived 2 weeks. And about the bucket list, I asked her, I said, you know, would you like to do? What would you like? Respect your bucket list. And she said, my bucket list is filled. Mm. I'm home with you.
Beautiful.
And so...
So a story, that story of reconciliation is very important. What do you hope to accomplish from your book? And describe the ideal reader for what you have included in your book, Hospice, The Last Responder.
The biggest thing I hope to accomplish is that people have a better understanding of hospice care. That they understand that hospice nurses and doctors will go anywhere to care for a patient or and a family member, that they will go there to care, not kill.
Hmm.
And I would like the healthcare workers all over the world to understand that 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 is what we do. It seems like in hospice care, because people are so afraid of the stigma attached to it, possibly because of the physician-assisted suicide that's going on around the world right now.
Right.
That they just don't understand that we don't kill patients. We are there to make sure those patients are symptom-free, that they are comfortable and hopefully awake, because the medications, if they could understand that every person that signs up for a hospice care has an interdisciplinary team, and that team consists of a doctor, social worker, nurse, case manager, team manager, chaplain, the whole team works together, and the whole team meets every week on every single patient they have. And they go through every symptom that patient is having that week, because the symptoms do change day by day or week by week. And that everyone is right on guard with those patients to make sure that they're comfortable. But we want them to spend as much quality time as they can with their family. We don't want to take 1 second away from that person.
Beautifully put. Beautifully put. The title of the book again is Hospice, The Last Responder. My guest has been author Ellen J. Windham. Ellen, you've included in here insight into Medicare in the United States and how that works and several other important topics. Where do my listeners get a copy of Hospice, The Last Responder?
They can get a copy of the book from Westbow Press. And I also have a website. It's www.hospicethelastresponder.com. It's available on ebook, softcover, and hardcover.
Excellent. And they can also order it from their local retailer, book retailer, if they choose to, by asking for it under the name of the book, Hospice, The Last Responder. And for anyone that has a senior family member that might be going through health crisis or may be destined for that, this is an important book for you to read, and regardless of your age, I think you'd find it not only informative, but also instructional in many, many areas. Thank you again, Ellen, for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.